Bartimaeus, chapter 16. The eagle hurtled down out of the night, angling painfully into the teeth of the gale, over the roofs, to the lonely crossroads, down to the statue. I alighted on the edge of the plinth, where rain spattered harshly against the stone. Everything was exactly as it had been a minute or two before, but the spaniel had gone. Queasel? No answer. Nothing but the howling of the wind. A moment later, perched on the horseman's hat, I scanned the seven roads on each of the seven plains. The spaniel was nowhere to be seen, nor were there any djinn, imps, hexes, or other magical effusions. The streets were deserted. I was quite alone. In doubt, I returned to the plinth and subjected it to a minute inspection. I thought to detect a faint black mark upon the stonework, roughly where we had been sitting, but it was impossible to tell whether or not it had been there before. All of a sudden, I felt very exposed. Whichever way I turned on the plinth, my back was vulnerable to something creeping up quietly out of the rain. I took off promptly and spiraled up around the statue, the crashing of the raindrops thrumming in my ears. Up above rooftop level I rose, safely out of reach of anything lurking in the street. It was then that I heard the crash. It wasn't a nice, restrained sort of crash, like a bottle breaking on a bald man's head, say. It sounded rather as if a large forest oak had been uprooted and tossed casually aside, or an entire building had been swatted impatiently out of the path of something very big. Unpromising, in other words. Worse still, I could tell the direction from which it came. If the rain had been just a little louder, or the crashing just a little quieter, I might have been able to misjudge it, and head off bravely to investigate in the wrong direction. But no such luck. Anyway, there was always the small possibility that Queasel might still be alive. So I did two things. First, I sent up another flare, hoping against hope that it would be spotted by another watcher in our group. The nearest, if memory served, was a Folliot, based somewhere down near Charing Cross. He was a meagre individual, devoid of valour or initiative, but any reinforcements would be welcome now, if only as cannon fodder. Next, I proceeded in a northerly direction, at Chimney Height along the road from which the sound had come. I was heading for the museum quarter. I flew about as slowly as an eagle can, without falling out of the air. If it's possible to flap your wings gingerly, that's exactly what I did. All the while I scanned the buildings below. It was an area of luxury shops, small, dark, discreet. Old painted signs above the doors hinted at the delights within. Necklaces, rolls of silk, jewelled pocket watches. Gold featured prominently in this district, diamonds likewise. It was to these establishments that magicians came to buy those little extras that emphasized their status. Rich tourists flocked here, too. The tremendous crash had not been repeated. All the shop fronts seemed healthy enough, their alcove lights burning, their wooden signs creaking in the wind. Rain fell around me, down into the street. In places, the cobbles had disappeared beneath the stippled surface of the water. There was no sign of anyone, mortal or otherwise. I might have been flying above a ghost town. The road widened a little, to pass on either side of a small circle of grass and pretty flowers. It seemed an incongruous sight in the narrow street, perhaps a little out of place. Then you noticed the old, broken post in the centre of the grass, the flagstones hidden amongst the flowers, and realized its original purpose. The name of the road, Gibbet Street, kind of gave the game away, too. The London authorities had always been good at setting examples for the commoners, although in recent years the bodies of felons were only hung up in the prison district around the tower. Elsewhere it was thought to deter tourism. Tonight it was all looking very waterblown and windswept, but what interested me, and made me circle round to land upon the post, were the markings in the grass. They were footprints, of a sort, large ones, vaguely spatula-shaped, with the imprint of one separate toe visible at the wider end. They crossed the grass circle from one side to the other, each print driven down deep into the earth. I shook moisture from my head feathers and drummed my claws against the post. Perfect. Just perfect. My enemy wasn't just mysterious and powerful. He was big and heavy, too. The night was getting better and better. I followed the direction of the footsteps with my eagle eye. For the first few steps beyond the grass, they were still partially visible, as indicated by a desultory trail of deposited mud. Beyond that, they disappeared, but it was clear that none of the shops on either side had suffered from the attentions of any marauder. My quarry was evidently heading elsewhere. I took off and continued on along the road. Gibbet Street came to its end at a wide boulevard that ran from left to right into the darkness. Directly opposite was a tall, imposing fence of metal railings, each post 6 meters high, 5 centimeters thick, and of solid iron. There was a set of double gates in the fence, and these were hanging open. In fact, to be accurate, they were hanging open off a nearby lamppost, together with a substantial portion of the adjoining rails. A great twisted hole gaped in the fencing. Something had ripped it in two in its hurry to get inside. How nice to be so eager! By contrast, it was with extreme reluctance that I approached, flying slowly across the street. I alighted on a wrenched and tortured tip of metal. Beyond the ruined gate was a broad driveway leading up to an expansive flight of steps. Above these was a giant portico of 8 imposing columns, attached to a vast building, tall as a castle, dull as a bank. I recognized it of old, the fabled British Museum. It stretched outwards in either direction, wing upon wing, further than my eyes could see. It was the size of a city block. The British Museum was home to 1 million antiquities, several dozen of which were legitimately come by. For 200 years prior to the magician's rule, London's rulers had made it their habit to filch anything interesting they could from countries where their traders called. It was something of a national addiction, based on curiosity and avarice. Lords and ladies taking the grand tour of Europe kept their eyes open for small treasures that could be stuffed unnoticed into handbags. Soldiers on campaign filled their chests with looted gems and reliquaries. Every merchant returning to the capital carried an extra crate of valuables in his hold. Most of these items made their eventual way to the ever-expanding collections of the British Museum, where they were set out on display with clear labels in many languages so that foreign tourists could come and see their lost valuables with minimum inconvenience. In due course, the magicians looted the museum of its magical items, but it remained an imposing cultural charnel house. Was it me, or was everything fairly big round here? The eagle fluffed up its feathers vigorously, but couldn't help feeling rather small. I considered the position. No prizes for guessing why the unknown, big-footed, and evidently rather strong enemy had come here. The museum held enough material worth destroying to keep it busy for a week. Whoever wished to heap embarrassment upon the British government had chosen well, and it was safe to say that my master's wretched career would not continue much longer if the marauder completed an uninterrupted night's work. Which, of course, meant that I had to follow it inside. Revenge was another motive for me now. I no longer held out much prospect of seeing Queasel alive again. The eagle glided forwards, low over the driveway and up over the steps to land between the columns of the portico. Ahead was the great bronze door of the museum. Typically, my quarry had decided to ignore it and staved its way through the solid stone wall instead. This sort of thing wasn't stylish, but had a bowel-looseningly impressive quality that made me spend a couple of extra minutes engaged in flagrant delaying tactics, such as checking the rubble of the portico carefully for danger. The hole in the building gaped wide and black. From a respectful distance I peered inside, into a lobby of a kind. All was still, no activity on any plane. A tumble of shattered wood and masonry and a splintered sign cheerfully proclaiming, "Welcome to the Britty," showed where something had shovelled its determined way. Dust hung thickly in the air. A wall on the left had been broken through. I listened hard. In the distance, behind the pummeling of the rain, I fancied I could hear the distinctive sound of priceless antiquities being broken. I sent another flare into the sky in case that shirking foliot chose to glance in my direction. Then I made my change and stepped into the building. The ferocious Minotaur glanced imperiously around the ruined lobby, steam rising from its nostrils, its clawed hands flexing, its hooves pawing at the dirt. Guaranteed to strike fear into a human enemy, does nothing better than a bull-headed minotaur, if you want a bit of the old shock and awe. And after centuries of careful honing, my particular minotaur guise was a doozy. The horns had just the right amount of curl, and the teeth were nicely sharpened, as if filed. The skin was blue-black ebony. I'd kept the human torso, but had gone for a satyr's goat legs and cloven hooves, which are that bit scarier than pimply knees and sandals. Who dared challenge it? No one. Well, no, because, as expected, there was nothing in the room. Right. Fine. That meant I had to try the next one. No problem. With a deep breath, the minotaur tiptoed tentatively through the debris to the splintered wall. It peeped round with great caution. Darkness, rain drumming on the windows, amphorae and Phoenician pots lying scattered on the floor, and somewhere distant, breaking glass. The enemy was still several rooms ahead. Good. The minotaur stepped bravely through. The next few minutes saw a rather slow game of cat and mouse, with this process repeated several times. New room, empty, sounds further on. The marauder went on its merrily destructive way. I trailed uncertainly in its wake, less keen than I strictly might have been to catch up with it. It wasn't exactly your traditional Bartimaeus panache, I'll admit. Call me overcautious, but Zeno's fate lay heavy on my mind, and I was trying to think of a foolproof plan to avoid being killed. The extent of the carnage I was passing made it seem unlikely that I was dealing with any human agency. So what would it be? An Afreet? Possible, but oddly out of style. You'd expect Afreets to use lots of magical attacks. High-class detonations and infernos, for instance. And there was no evidence of anything here except sheer brute force. A married? Same again. And surely I'd have sensed their magical presence before now. Marrieds radiate so much power that it is possible to track their recent movements by following a residual magical trail. They leave it hanging in the atmosphere, much as a snail deposits slime. It isn't wise to use this analogy to a married's face, of course. But I was getting no familiar feedback. All the rooms were dead and cold. This was in line with what the boy had told me about the previous attacks. It did not seem that spirits were involved at all. To be absolutely sure, I sent a small magical pulse bubbling ahead of me through the next jagged hole from which loud noises were emanating. I waited for the pulse to return, either weaker, if no magic lay ahead, or stronger, if something potent lurked in wait. To my consternation, it did not come back at all. The minotaur rubbed its muzzle thoughtfully. Odd and vaguely familiar. I was sure I'd seen this effect somewhere before. I listened at the hole. Once again, the only sounds were distant ones. The minotaur sneaked through, and came out in a large gallery, double the height of the other rooms. The rain beat against tall rectangular windows high up on either side, and from somewhere in the night, perhaps some distant tower, a faint white light shone down upon the contents of the hall. It was a room filled with ancient statues of colossal size, all swathed in shadow. Two Assyrian gatekeeper djinn, winged lions with the heads of men, which had once stood before the gates of Nimrud. These were stone representations only. In the glory days of Assyria, the djinn would have been real, asking riddles of strangers in a manner similar to the Sphinx, and devouring them if the answer was incorrect, ungrammatical, or simply spoken in a rustic accent. They were punctilious beasts. A motley assembly of Egyptian gods and spirits carved in a dozen kinds of coloured stone and given the heads of crocodile, cat, ibis, and jackal. This last one, old Anubis, always unnerves me if I spot it out of the corner of my eye, but gradually I'm learning to relax. Jabor is long gone. Huge carved representations of the holy scarab beetle, sarcophagi of long-forgotten priests, and above all, fragments of the monolithic statues of the great pharaohs, shattered faces, arms, torsos, hands and feet, found buried in the sands and carried by sail and steamship to the grey lands of the north. On another occasion, I could have had a nostalgic trip here, looking for images of distant friends and masters, but now was not the time. A clear corridor had been driven halfway through the hall. Several smaller pharaohs had already been bunted aside and lay like ninepins in indignant heaps on the margins, while a couple of gods were in closer proximity to each other than they would have cared for in life. But if these had given little trouble, some of the larger statues seemed to be putting up more resistance. Halfway down the hall, and directly in the path that the enemy was taking, rose a giant seated figure of Rameses the Great, more than 9 meters high and carved from solid granite. The top of its headdress was gently shaking. Muffled scraping sounds came from the darkness below, suggesting that something was trying to force Rameses from its path. Rameses wouldn't have been surprised that his statue was proving so troublesome. He had the biggest ego of any human it's been my misfortune to serve. This despite being small, bandy-legged, and with a face as pockmarked as a rhino's bottom. His magicians, however, were strong and inflexible. For 40 years I laboured on grandiose building projects on his behalf, along with 1,000 other benighted spirits. Even an Utuku would have figured out, after a couple of minutes, that the easiest thing to do was to walk round something so big and just head off on its travels. But my enemy was worrying away at the statue like a small dog trying to lift an elephant's shinbone. So perhaps, a positive thought, my adversary was very stupid. Or perhaps, less positive this, it was simply ambitious, intent on causing maximum destruction. Anyway, it was evidently happily occupied for the present, and this gave me the opportunity to take a closer look at what I was up against. Without a sound, the minotaur minced through the blackness of the hall until it came to a tall sarcophagus that so far remained untouched. It peered round it towards the base of Rameses' statue, and frowned in perplexity. Most djinn have perfect night sight. It's one of the countless ways in which we are superior to humans. Darkness has little meaning for us, even on the first plane, which you see too. But now, though I scrolled through the other planes with the speed of thought, I found I could not penetrate a deep well of blackness centred on the statue's base. It swelled and shrank around its edges, but remained as inkily inscrutable on the seventh plane as on the first. Whatever was causing Rameses to shake was deep within the darkness, but I could see nothing of it. However, I could certainly judge roughly where it would be, and since it was being good enough to remain stationary, it seemed the time had come for a surprise attack. I looked around for an appropriate missile. In a glass cabinet nearby was an odd black stone of irregular outline, small enough to lift, but large enough to brain an afreet nicely. It had a lot of scribbling down one flat side, which I didn't have time to read. It was probably a set of rules for visitors to the museum, since it seemed to be written in 2 or 3 languages. Whatever, it was just the job. The Minotaur carefully and quietly lifted the glass case off the floor and over the top of the rock, setting it down again without a sound. It checked across. The blackness still welled aggressively against Rameses' feet, but the statue remained immobile. Good. With a bend and a lift, the rock was in the Minotaur's brawny arms, and I was heading back across the gallery, looking for a suitable vantage point. A smallish pharaoh met my eye. I didn't recognize him. He can't have been one of the more memorable ones. Even his statue had a slightly apologetic expression. But he was sitting high up on a curved throne on top of a dais, and his lap looked big enough for a Minotaur to stand on. Still holding the rock, I hopped up, first onto the dais, then onto the throne, then onto the pharaoh's lap. I squinted over his shoulder. Perfect. I was a stone's throw away from the pulsating blackness now, high up enough to get just the right trajectory. I tensed my goat legs, flexed my biceps, gave a snort for luck, and tossed the stone up and over, as if from a siege catapult. For a single second, maybe two, its inscribed surface flashed in the light from the windows. Then it had plummeted down in front of Rameses' face, down to the base of the statue, and into the centre of the black smog. Smack! A crack of stone on stone, rock upon rock. Small black pieces flew out of the smog in all directions, pinging off the masonry and cracking glass. Well, I'd hit something, and it was hard. The black cloud boiled as if in sudden rage. Briefly it drew back. I caught a glimpse of something very large and solid at its heart, thrashing a giant arm about in mindless fury. Then the cloud closed up again and swelled outwards, lapping against the nearest statues, as if blindly seeking the perpetrator of the crime. In point of fact, the heroic Minotaur had made itself scarce. I was crouching down as low as possible in the Pharaoh's lap, peeping out through a crack in the marble. Even my horns had drooped a little, so as not to be exposed. I watched the darkness move now, as whatever was inside it began its hunt. It shifted decisively away from Ramesses' base, welling back and forth against nearby statues. A series of heavy impacts sounded, the noise of hidden footfalls. While it was true to say that my hopes for my first attack hadn't been sky-high, given that my adversary was capable of smashing through solid walls, I was a little disappointed that the stone hadn't made more impact. But it had given me a tiny glimpse of the creature within, and since, if I couldn't destroy it, one of my charges was to get information on the marauder, this was something worth following up. A small stone had made a small dent in the darkness. This being so, what would a large stone do? The billowing cloud was moving off to investigate a suspicious group of statues on the opposite side of the hall. With unlikely stealth, the Minotaur descended from the Pharaoh's lap and proceeded in a series of little darting movements between hiding places, across the gallery to where a large sandstone torso of another pharaoh stood beside the wall. The cartouche on its chest proclaimed it to be Amos of the 18th dynasty, he who unites in glory. Since he was currently lacking his own head, legs, and arms, this boast rang a little hollow. The torso was high, about 4 meters tall. I squeezed into the shadows behind it, on my way plucking a small burial pot off a nearby stand. Once suitably concealed, I stuck out a hairy arm and tossed the pot to the ground 3 meters or so away. It broke with a satisfyingly crisp crack. Instantly, as if it had been waiting for just such a sound, the cloud of darkness shifted position and began flowing rapidly in the direction of the noise. Eager footfalls sounded. Questing tentacles of blackness extended out, whipping against the statues as they passed. The cloud drew close to the smashed pot. It paused there, billowing uncertainly. It was in position. By this time the Minotaur had climbed halfway up the sandstone torso, braced its back against the wall behind, and was pushing at the statue with all the might of its cloven hooves. The torso began to shift immediately, rocking back and forth, and making a slight scraping sound as it did so. My adversary should have borne the principles of leverage in mind when trying to shift Ramesses. As I once told Archimedes, give me a lever long enough and I will move the world. In this case, the world was a tad ambitious, but a 6-ton headless torso suited me just fine. The cloud of blackness caught the noise. It darted in my direction. Not fast enough. With one final heave, the torso's center of balance shifted irrevocably. Down it came, whistling through the dark hall, slap-bang into the cloud. The force of the impact blew the cloud into a million ragged wisps. They shot out in all directions. I jumped clear, landing nimbly to the side. I turned eagerly, scanning the scene. The torso was not flat against the ground. It had cracked across the middle. Its top end was a meter off the floor, as if it were resting on something large. I walked towards it carefully. From my angle, I couldn't get a view of what was lying comatose beneath. Still, it looked as if I'd been successful. In a few moments I could head off, signal the boy, and get ready for my dismissal. I drew close, bent down to look beneath the statue. A giant hand shot out, faster than thought, grabbed me by one hairy leg. It was blue-gray, possessed of 3 fingers and a thumb, hard and cold as buried stone. Veins ran through it as through marble, but they pulsed with life. Its grip crushed my essence like a vice. The Minotaur bellowed with pain. I needed to change to withdraw my essence from the fist, but my head was spinning. I could not concentrate long enough to do so. A terrible coldness extended outwards, wrapped itself around me like a blanket. I felt my fires dwindling, my energy leaching out of me like blood dripping from a wound. The Minotaur swayed, collapsed like an empty puppet upon the floor. the chilly solitude of death was all about me. Then, unexpectedly, the stone wrist flexed, the grip was loosed. The Minotaur's body was hurled high into the air in an ungainly arc, to be dashed hard against the nearby wall. My consciousness flickered. I fell, crashing tail over horns, to the floor below. I lay there for a moment, dazed, uncomprehending. I heard scraping sounds, as of a sandstone torso being shifted, and did nothing. I felt the floor shake, as of that torso being summarily dropped to one side, and did nothing. I heard first one, then another, firm concussion, as of great stone feet righting themselves, and still did nothing. But all the while the hideous burning chill of the great hand's touch was slowly lessening, and my fires were being restoked. And now, as the great stone feet moved purposefully towards me, and I sensed something fixing me with a cold intent, enough energy returned for action. I opened my eyes, saw a shadow looming. With a tortured effort of will, the Minotaur became the cat once more. The cat leaped high into the air, out of the path of the descending foot, which drove deep down into the fabric of the floor. The cat landed a short way off, hackles raised, tail flared like a toilet brush. With a yowl it leaped again. As it leaped, it looked to the side and caught a view of its adversary, full on. The black wisps were reforming about it already, gathering like mercury globules into the creature's permanent concealing shroud. But enough remained free for me to see it there, its outline exposed in the moonlight, following my leap with a swift turn of its head. At first glance, it was as if one of the statues in the hall had come to life. A vast figure, roughly humanoid in shape, standing 3 meters tall. Two arms, two legs, a hulking torso, a relatively small, smooth head sitting atop it all. It existed only on the first plane. On the others, darkness was utter and absolute. The cat landed on the scaly head of Sobek, the crocodile god, and perched there for a moment, hissing defiance. Everything about the figure radiated an alien otherness. I felt my energy being sapped simply by seeing it. It stepped towards me with surprising speed. For an instant, its face, such as it was caught in the light from the window. And that was where the comparison with the ancient statues fell down. Those statues were exquisitely carved, without exception. That was what the Egyptians were really good at, along with organized religion and civil engineering. But aside from its scale, the most obvious thing about the creature was how crude it was, how artificial. The skin surface was covered in irregularities, in lumps, cracks, and flat areas, as if it had only roughly been patted into shape. It had no ears, no hair. Where you'd expect its eyes to be, it had 2 round holes that looked as if they'd simply been punched in its surface with the blunt end of a giant pencil. It had no nose, and only a great slash of a mouth, which hung slightly open in the stupid, voracious manner of a shark's. And in the centre of its forehead was an oval shape that I knew I'd seen before, not very long ago. This oval was fairly small, fashioned out of the same dark blue-grey substance as the rest of the figure, but was as intricate as the face and body were crude. It was an open eye, without lids or lashes, but complete with cross-hatched iris and round pupil, and in the centre of that pupil, just before the cloak of blackness swathed it from my view, I caught the flash of a dark intelligence watching me. The blackness made a lunge. The cat gave a bound. Behind me I heard Sobek splintering. I landed on the floor, shot towards the nearest door. It was time to go. I had discovered what I needed. I did not flatter myself I could do anything more here. A missile of some kind shot over my head, collided with the door, staving it in. The cat plunged through. Jarring footsteps came behind. I was in a small, dark room, hung with fragile ethnic drapes and tapestries. A tall window at the end promised a way out. The cat ran towards it, whiskers back, ears flat against its head, claws scrabbling on the floor. It jumped, jerked to the side at the last minute with a very uncat-like curse, It had seen the glowing white lines of a high-strength nexus beyond the window. The magicians had arrived. They'd sealed us in. The cat wheeled round, seeking another exit, finding none. Bloody magicians! A boiling cloud of darkness filled the doorway. The cat hunched down defensively, pressing itself against the floor. Behind it, rain drummed against the window panes. For a moment, neither cat nor darkness moved. Then something small and white erupted from the cloud, shooting across the room. The crocodile head of Sobek ripped from its shoulders. The cat sprang aside. The head crashed through the window, fizzing as it struck the nexus. Hot rain drove in through the hole, steaming from its contact with the barrier. With it came a sudden draught. The tapestries and sheets of fabric on the walls fluttered outwards. Footsteps. An approaching darkness. It seemed to swell to fill the room. The cat slunk back into a corner, pressing itself as small as it would go. Any moment now that eye would see me. Another gust of rain. The edges of the tapestries flicked up. An idea formed. Not a very good one, but I wasn't fussy right then. The cat leaped at the nearest hanging fabric, a fragile piece, possibly from America, showing squarish humans amid a sea of stylized corn. It scrabbled its way to the top, where careful cords attached it to the wall. A flash of claw. The fabric was free. Instantly the wind caught it. It blew outwards into the room, colliding with something in the midst of the black cloud. The cat was already on the next tapestry, slashing it loose. Then the next. In a moment, half a dozen sheets of fabric had been whipped into the centre of the room, where they danced palely like ghosts amid the wind and driving rain. The creature in the cloud had ripped the first sheet away, but now another was blown upon it. From all sides, fragments of material dipped and spun, confusing the creature, obscuring its view. I sensed the great arms flailing, the giant legs blundering back and forth within the confines of the room. While it was thus occupied, I aimed to creep elsewhere. This was easier said than done, as the black cloud now seemed to fill the room, and I didn't want to bump into the death-bringing body within it. So I went cautiously, hugging the walls. I'd made it about halfway, when the creature, evidently reaching a peak of frustration, lost all sense of perspective. There was a sudden pounding of feet, and a great blow struck against the left-hand wall. Plaster dropped from above, and a cloud of dust and debris fell into the room, to join the general whirl of wind, rain, and antique fabrics. On the second blow, the wall collapsed, and with it the entire ceiling. For a split second, the cat was motionless, eyes wide. Then it curled into a protective ball. An instant later, a dozen tons of stone, brick, cement, steel, and assorted masonry crashed down directly upon me, burying the room.